ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. Water pouring down on Nevada. And a whole lot of it at the Burning Man Festival in Black Rock. Attendees were told to shelter in place and conserve food and water. Authorities say at least one person at the festival has died, though the cause is under investigation. In Las Vegas, floodwaters filled streets and trapped motorists. President Biden pledging federal support for residents of Florida impacted by Hurricane Idalia. Biden surveyed the damage during a tour on Saturday. Notably absent from Biden's visit was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who declined to join the president, suggesting that it may hinder disaster response. The White House pushed back on that. Drone strikes ahead of a meeting between Turkey's president and Russian President Vladimir Putin. The two leaders set to meet on Monday as Turkey aims to broker a deal to restart food shipments from Ukraine through the Black Sea. But ahead of that, Russia has unleashed a barrage of drone strikes on the port region of Odessa. This is ABC News. NASCAR driver Ryan Preece speaking publicly about a harrowing crash on the track last week.
On his recovery from the spectacular airborne flipping and crashing into his Florida NASCAR competition last weekend at Daytona, Preece.
When you get sideways like that, and as you go in the air, it gets real quiet. After experiencing that, that's 100% true. Everything beyond that, everything's happening so fast. And, you know, you're just flipping through the air. Until that ride stops, all you're thinking about is just trying to contain yourself.
As a result, Preece still had bloodshot eyes Saturday. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams responding to criticism over a plan to use law enforcement drones to surveil large groups over the holiday weekend, with NYPD saying they'll even be using them to watch backyard parties, potentially. Adams says the drones are meant to be used only as a tool if officers are called to respond. The plan, though, drawing criticism from privacy and civil liberties advocates, including the New York Civil Liberties Union. Mark Remillard, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Working hard is a long-standing tradition in Wisconsin. Some of the first labor unions formed here because of it. This Labor Day, join Earl Ingram as he hosts a special The Earl Ingram Show live from 8 to 11 a.m. at Labor Fest in Milwaukee.
Many people don't work on Labor Day, and so all they know is it's a day off. As a person who spent 34 years in labor and was a union man, I know the value of that.
Earl and his guests will discuss how Wisconsin's labor-related legislation became a model for other states, along with what unions look like now.
I've seen us go from that 30% union membership to now in Wisconsin, somewhere around 12%.
A union-led parade meets up with festgoers on the Summerfest grounds at 11. Labor Fest is free and open to all. Join Earl Ingram live this Labor Day, Monday, September 4th, starting at 8 a.m. from Labor Fest in Milwaukee, only here on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The governor of Utah wants people to learn how to disagree. Republican Spencer Cox is leading a campaign called Disagree Better. It encourages more positive approaches to politics and social discourse. Here's Alex Gonzalez.
The day after the first Republican presidential debate, Cox took to X and shared a video where he said he has found listening to understand as opposed to listening to debate is a powerful tool.
Healthy disagreement is about staying true to who we are, to the principles that we believe in, but also not attacking the person who disagrees with us.
Cox acknowledges that the United States is deeply divided and a majority of Americans are tired of the division and hyperpartisanship. According to the Pew Research Center, partisanship continues to be the dividing line in the American public's political attitudes, far surpassing other markers such as age, race, and ethnicity. Cox says the nation was created with 50 states, of which he calls laboratories of democracy. He says each state is uniquely positioned to work together and learn from one another. The Disagree Better initiative has a list of recommended strategies and tools for state and local leaders to implement in an effort to ease tensions.
Because what happens is when we're curious, when we're really trying to understand where the other person is coming from, they're much more likely to give us that same opportunity and to listen to us.
Cox says it's an important message with the 2024 presidential primaries in full effect. A recent poll found that more Americans viewed neither President Joe Biden, the likely Democratic nomination, nor former President Donald Trump, the clear frontrunner for the Republican Party, in a favorable light than those who saw either of them favorably. And I'm Alex Gonzalez. Find our HRUST indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And you're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Powell.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Second, 2023. This is Morning Cannolis, and yes, my name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour and also next hour. I am delighted, along with my wonderful producer, Anya, to have you with us this morning. We're going to be talking about many, many important things animating our world just this past week. We've got a great number of lessons in civics this morning, all sorts of procedures we're going to talk about along the way, principally, although not exclusively, in the area of criminal prosecutions. As always, this is our weekly review, our analysis, and our discussion of those very most important stories and events and things happening in the areas of law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. We're coming to you from the studios of Civic Media right here in Waukesha, but broadcasting on the broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout this great state of Wisconsin and even beyond. As I indicated this morning and throughout all of our broadcasts, we're delighted to have you with us this morning. Also taking your phone calls and, yes, indeed, your texts about your comments, your questions, your observations that you may have about the subject matters that we're talking about this morning, getting to that in just a moment or so. You can call us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. And you can also text us. Yes, you can text us through the app of Civic Media. Just go online, identify your particular broadcast station, pull us down. It is Morning Cannolis, and send a text to my wonderful producer, Anya, and she will get that before me, and we'll take those texts, those comments, those questions as well. Again, delighted to have you a part of our discussion this morning, this hour, and also next. As always, we ask three important questions on Morning Cannolis about the stories that animate those areas of law, government, and justice in these great United States of America. We ask what happened. What are the facts? What do we know about the events of our days this past week? Lots of different things in the area, principally, although not exclusively, in the area of criminal prosecution. Why important? Why are these things relevant? Are they material to our lives? Why should we care? We ask that question, hopefully provide some answers to that question as well. And then in many instances, not all, but many instances, what do we do about it? What are our responses to these things? What kinds of things should we say in answer, in follow-up? What are our actions in response to the things that are happening all around us? So asking those questions once again this morning, we do have, as always, this ambitious but very achievable syllabus and agenda for this morning, hopefully informative to you, hopefully maybe even inspiring to you when it comes to understanding the world in which we live. Let me talk with you a bit about that ambitious but achievable agenda this morning. We're going to be talking again about many different processes in the course of the civil proceedings and criminal proceedings in our federal and our state courts. We're going to be talking initially about some very important sentences imposed just the past couple of days by a federal district court judge in Washington, D.C., against some of the mid-level organizers, supervisors, organizers, producers, if you will, of the January 6th insurrection, the Proud Boys, four of them sentenced this past week, not including their principal organizer and director, a fellow named Enrique Tarrio, his sentencing put off for some point in the near future, but four other defendants. We're going to talk at great detail this morning about what the nature of those sentencings, describe for you exactly what these folks said during the course of those sentencing proceedings, because they reveal a lot about the reasons why these prosecutions are so important. They tell us a lot about the animation of these and other people for going to January 6th, the events of January 6th in Washington, D.C. on that day. And they describe, with one notable exception, which we'll also get to, their great contrition, their sorrow, their sobbing in court this past week for the things that they did 2.5 years ago in January 6th, following at that time the invitation of the former President Donald Trump, believing that he was telling them the truth and discovering, of course, along the way, not that day, but in the wake of their involvement in the January 6th riot, the attack on our Capitol on that day, understanding that what he said to them was a lie and that they had relied upon his statements to them to their great detriment. Some of them now facing almost two decades in prison. We're going to talk about those in particular. We're going to talk beyond that about other threats to our democracy when it comes to election workers. We're going to talk about an attorney general. His name is Merrick Garland, who this past week announced a new task force on election worker terrorism and attempt to intimidate election workers in our nation. I'm going to chat in particular also about a particular civil case that had to do with Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss, that is the two election workers in Georgia, a significant civil event involving their achieving the result in this civil case against Rudy Giuliani. A case of defamation, and chatting there again about the importance of deterrence, both civil and criminal. One of the reasons for doing all of this, of course, is to ensure that people not only stop their own behavior, but that others who might hear about these, including things like the Proud Boys who might be down there, out there in the future, other people who might be threatening election workers in the future, know that there are results, there are consequences to those actions. A lot of that having to do with law enforcement and the criminal side, but also civil prosecution that also has that same impact upon our citizenry. Let me go to Georgia. Almost the same time that many of these things are happening, we know as well that in the state of Georgia, Fani Willis, the DA in Fulton County, has brought this omnibus, very sweeping indictment against 19 individuals for their involvement in trying to undermine, to stop the processing, the counting, the taking of voting of elections in Georgia during the course of the 2020 election. And we're going to talk about a particular event that happened in federal court in Georgia. One of the defendants in that sweeping indictment, his name is Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff of the White House under Donald Trump, in court trying to convince the federal judge that the state court case pending in state court should in fact be brought into federal court on the basis that he was acting when he did the conduct described in the indictment. He was acting in the scope and duties of his responsibilities as a federal officer, and therefore it should be in federal court. We'll talk about the merits and, yes, indeed, the demerits of that position, the highly unlikely nature of the result from that, almost certainly to be predicted from the judge there, indicating that that case will stay in state court. Then we're going to talk about some other matters also related to the course of processing of criminal cases. We've got a trial date that was set just this past week by the federal district court judge, this one back in Washington, D.C., setting the trial date for the January 6th federal indictment against a singular defendant. His name is Donald Trump, on four counts involving, among other things, a conspiracy to violate your civil rights, your rights to a proper and decent election, setting that trial date for early 2024. We'll talk about the other trials that are coming up, one of them civil, many of the rest of them criminal as well, others that are going to be happening in 2024. They're going to be right up against that trial date, if indeed it stays on the court calendar. I'm going to also chat about a fellow named Peter Navarro. You have not heard his name in a long period of time. He's going to trial on Monday in a matter involving contempt of Congress. We'll chat about that as well. going to chat in our second hour then about the Supreme Court. Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito making some disclosures this past week. And then we're going to go back to what we've been doing over the period of the past several weeks. That is doing some reviews, some specific analysis of what it says in that January 6th indictment, the one that's now scheduled for trial in the early part of 2024. I'm going to go back this morning and talk in particular about the attempts undertaken by the former president and at least one of the unnamed co-conspirators in that case, named as a co-conspirator, named as a defendant in the Georgia case. His name is Jeffrey Clark. The attempts by the former president to involve, yes, your United States Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, bringing the United States Department of Justice in this attempt to undermine your vote and to send messages not only to other states but also to the United States Congress that the vote, the popular vote, giving the election to Joe Biden, resulting in the Electoral College vote counted by the Congress on January 6th, should not, in fact, have been proceeded. Go ahead with that particular proceeding on that day. I'm going to talk about the significance of that as set forth in that January 6th indictment in our second hour this morning. Indeed, very ambitious but achievable, all of that on our syllabus this morning. Thank you once again for joining us. We're at 844-967-2789, and then also taking your texts again through Civic Media, Morning Cannolis, through your particular radio station. Let's begin, as I indicated, by talking about two important sentencings that happened on Thursday, two more on Friday, involving people involved in the January 6th insurrection, the riot of that day. What is the reason why you do sentencing at the outset? Well, again, we do this for two very important reasons. In our system of justice, most systems of justice have deterrence as a key feature, a key factor. We want to deter the person who engaged in the conduct. We want to say you can't continue to do this. We're going to stop you individually from doing what you have done. And that is certainly the case with respect to the four defendants sentenced just this past week. Messages sent by the federal district court judge, unequivocal, that if you engage in this conduct, again, even after you're out of prison some 18, 17, 10 years from now, if you engage in that conduct again, there will be a consequence to that. So deterrence, stopping them from doing that particular conduct, certainly also during the time that they're going to be in prison, beginning just this past week, beginning even before this past week. And the second reason for engaging in sentencing, doing this criminal process of sentencing, imposing a criminal sentence on people, is general deterrence. Beyond just specific deterrence as to the individual, general deterrence, sending that message to all of us. Any of the future people out there, the future Proud Boys, the future Oath Keepers, future people who might attempt in 2024, 2026, 2028, any future elections in our nation to undermine the legitimacy of that, that there will be consequences to that as well, stopping them before they do that in the first place. And so those all-important reasons for deterrence very much on show, on display in our civics lessons this morning, involving at least four of these defendants sentenced just this past week. We know, as we have described in the past, that Enrique Tarrio, the head of the Proud Boys, is going to be sentenced down the road. He was scheduled to be sentenced this past week. The government already seeking a very significant penalty against him. When we come back, we'll talk about the others, his co-conspirators on January 6th. Four defendants sentenced this past week, significant terms in federal prison, what the judge said, what they said, what we can take away from those all-important sentences coming up right after this first break.
We're in the Civic Media Truth Booth at the Brown County Fair. We asked, and here's what you are telling us about living in the Green Bay area, attending the fair, and more.
Novalee Phelps. I work at the fair at Sheridan Amusements. I work with the kiddie rides. I set up, tear down, wash them, and run them, and make little kids happy. I run the raceway. I set it up, tear it down. I help with other kiddie rides. I love to put a smile on kids' faces.
Thanks for sharing your story. Listen for more on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 97.9 FM, 1590 AM, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM, 98.3 FM, and the Civic Media app. And our website, civicmedia.us, and search for Truth Booth. And watch for the Civic Media Truth Booth coming to your town soon.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know what's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
We are back this morning on Morning Cannolis. Thank you for staying with me on our discussion this morning, initially in this segment of our broadcast, of these four very important sentences imposed upon people who were involved in the January 6th insurrection, particular associated with the Proud Boys. The Proud Boys, this nationalist white supremacist group, now effectively dismantled because of the prosecutions brought against them in the wake of January 6th. Let's get right to those four different sentences imposed on Thursday and Friday of this past week. Lengthy prison terms on Thursday and again on Friday. First of all, on Thursday, a top lieutenant in this far-right group, his name is Joseph Biggs, B-I-G-G-S. He was given 17 years in federal prison, 17 years, just shy of the most severe sentence imposed to date. That's 18 years. We'll talk about that in just a moment or so. And another key figure in this attack, his name is Zachary Rehl, R-E-H-L. He got 15 years, all of that imposed by the federal district court judge. His name is Timothy Kelly, federal district court in Washington, D.C., where all of these sentencings, all of these prosecutions having taken place over the period of the past several months, continuing to this date, about 1,100 people already in the process, many of those convicted, sentenced, many of those still awaiting their resolutions of their case. Along the way, these two on Thursday, and two more than just yesterday on Friday. Those sentences kicked off this series of hearings just this past week involving, again, Enrique Tarrio, his particular sentence. He is the leader of the Proud Boys, postponed to a future date. Hours after the sentencing, Mr. Biggs, Judge Kelly imposed a 15-year sentence on Mr. Rehl, who, again, Zachary Rehl, getting 15 years for his involvement. Prosecutors had sought a 30-year term for Rehl, obviously much lower the amount of time that the judge imposed in this particular case. As I indicated, these prosecutions of these two, these four, all but dismantled the Proud Boys, decapitated the group's national leadership effectively, and made them ineffective with respect to any future engagement under the Proud Boys' mantle in any event. Concerns down the road about people who might still be out there who are still advancing the Proud Boys' anti-government approach to life in America. But plainly, these are very important, again, for the deterrent purposes that I described before. Mr. Biggs himself, Joseph Biggs, again, given 17 years, effectively ended what was an unusual career. Included a stint as a combat soldier, a job as a roving correspondent for conspiracy theory website called InfoWars, as you probably well recognize, a leadership role in the Proud Boys at a moment when that far-right group was thrust into this role, if you will, national politics on January 6th at the center of this particular election. Biggs was one of Enrique Tarrio's closest confidants, And beyond that, he was specifically identified, if you will, that is the entire Proud Boy group, you may recall well that Donald Trump very famously called out the organization during a presidential debate against Joe Biden in 2020, telling its members to stand back and stand by. Those were words sent to these Proud Boys and others. So what happened? What happened during the course of the sentencing this past week? Let's talk first about Mr. Rell, this fellow Zachary Rell, who got 15 years imposed by the federal district court judge. He was racked by sobs during the course of his hearing. He apologized to his family and his friends, and even apologized to the prosecution team, telling Judge Kelly, the presiding officer, that he believed the lies about the election that were spread by politicians, including the former president of the United States of America, his name, of course, Donald Trump. He said, that is, the defendant said, "I'm done peddling lies for other people who don't care about me," which is a common theme to many of these, relying upon Donald Trump's representations to them and finding themselves on the receiving end of these very significant prosecutions and now these sentences imposed upon them as well, without any support, any follow-up from the former president himself or anybody else. And that, of course, was to be understood. That's the way that Donald Trump proceeds in his life. When Mr. Biggs addressed the court, he said that he had turned to drinking after coming back from combat overseas, and that the only group he wanted to be affiliate with those days, these days now, is his daughter's PTA. He said, "I know that I messed up that day, but I'm not a terrorist," he said to the judge. Judge Kelly, returning to specifically that point, said that Biggs had been involved significantly in the attack on the Capitol, helped to instigate it, was a national disgrace, described it that way. What happened on January 6th, the judge said, harmed an important American custom. That day broke our tradition of peacefully transferring power, which is among the most precious things we have as Americans. Notice that I said had. We don't have it anymore. Those are comments made by the federal district court judge imposing sentence upon Mr. Biggs, Joseph Biggs, this sentence of 17 years, imposing that sentence on Joseph Biggs, Zachary Rell getting 15 years. All of this a part of the continuing prosecution happening in Washington, D.C. On January 6th, Biggs himself took part in an episode outside the Capitol that morning that was pretty widely seen as a tipping point, a very important point in the overall riot. You may recall that from some of the reporting on this that he had a private conversation with a man in the crowd. His name was Ryan Samsel. And after that, Samsel approached a barricade and confronted the police, and that resulted in the first breach of the Capitol's security perimeter on that day. So the involvement of Biggs in particular, seen as sort of this spark that initiated a lot of the rioting that followed on that day. That's why the judge looking to him and looking to others and saying that they were centrally involved in this attempt to overthrow our government. During the course of all of this, even before the sentencing and other matters, Biggs recorded a podcast after the riot. He described that the attack on the Capitol was a warning shot to the government and went on to talk about the importance of doing all of this. Now, Judge Kelly's decision to impose these important sentences was a part of a terrorism enhancement. And when we come back, I'm going to tell you more about that, the reason why these significant sentences of 17 years, 15 years were as they were, not as high as the government requested. We'll talk more about the reasons for imposing those sentences and more about the things that happened in court just this past week.
Where the fans own the team. This is the talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. Water pouring down on Nevada, and a whole lot of it at the Burning Man Festival in Black Rock. Attendees were told to shelter in place and conserve food and water. Authorities say at least one person at the festival has died, though the cause is under investigation. In Las Vegas, floodwaters filled streets and trapped motorists. President Biden pledging federal support for residents of Florida impacted by Hurricane Idalia. Biden surveyed the damage during a tour on Saturday. Notably absent from Biden's visit was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who declined to join the president, suggesting that it may hinder disaster response. The White House pushed back on that. Drone strikes ahead of a meeting between Turkey's president and Russian President Vladimir Putin. The two leaders set to meet on Monday as Turkey aims to broker a deal to restart food shipments from Ukraine through the Black Sea. But ahead of that, Russia has unleashed a barrage of drone strikes on the port region of Odessa. This is ABC News.
Working hard is a long-standing tradition in Wisconsin. Some of the first labor unions formed here because of it. This Labor Day, join Earl Ingram as he hosts a special The Earl Ingram Show live from 8 to 11 a.m. at Labor Fest in Milwaukee.
Many people don't work on Labor Day, and so all they know is it's a day off. As a person who spent 34 years in labor and was a union man, I know the value of that.
Earl and his guests will discuss how Wisconsin's labor-related legislation became a model for other states, along with what unions look like now.
I've seen us go from that 30% union membership to now in Wisconsin, somewhere around 12%.
A union-led parade meets up with festgoers on the Summerfest grounds at 11. Labor Fest is free and open to all. Join Earl Ingram live this Labor Day, Monday, September 4th, starting at 8 a.m. from Labor Fest in Milwaukee, only here on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app. We're in the Civic Media Truth Booth at the Brown County Fair. We asked, and here's what you are telling us about living in the Green Bay area, attending the fair, and more.
Novalee Phelps. I work at the fair at Sheridan Amusements. I work with the Kitty Rides. I set up, tear down, wash them, and run them, make little kids happy. I run the raceway. I set it up, tear it down. I help with other kitty rides. I love putting a smile on kids' faces.
Thanks for sharing your story. Listen for more on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 97.9 FM, 1590 AM, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM, 98.3 FM, and the Civic Media app. And our website, civicmedia.us, and search for Truth Booth. And watch for the Civic Media Truth Booth coming to your town soon.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
And apparently, Maggie Dawn, big Newton lover of the Maggie Dawn Show.
I was so offended, Jane. You know how much I love and admire you. You're like my freaking radio hero. And then to hear you bash my Newton.
It's still bad.
You want the cakey part cakey. You want the jammy part jammy. That is like bringing me back.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
We are back. We're talking this morning all about these important sentencings imposed by a federal district court judge in Washington, D.C., among members of the group formerly known as the Proud Boys, no longer a part of the existence in America. A good thing coming out of these prosecutions, the investigations and prosecutions of them. Proud Boys no longer in existence, but the conduct, the focus of a lot of commentary, a lot of discussion in the federal district court this past week in Washington, D.C. We were chatting right before the break about the imposition of sentences upon two of those defendants. Joseph Biggs given 17 years in federal prison. Another key figure is Zachary Rell getting 15 years. And all of that a result of the decision by Judge Kelly, the federal district court judge, in those proceedings to impose what's known as a terrorism enhancement on both of those sentences. One of the most consequential things happening during the course of all of these sentencings, that measure applied to prosecutors of government, United States of America, can show that the defendant's action was undertaken, was pursued in such a way to influence the conduct of the government by intimidation and coercion. That's the language that that goes along with this terrorism enhancement. Biggs, in particular, did not engage in any violence against people. So this particular enhancement emerged from a charge in which he was found guilty of damaging a government-owned fence in a way that allowed the rioters to surge forward. That part of this description we talked about right before this break. And so Judge Kelly imposing that upon these particular defendants, finding once again their involvement in terrorism attempts on that particular day. All of that happening on Thursday of this past week, again, involving these two members of the group now no longer in existence called the Proud Boys. On Friday, the judge then taking up two other defendants, also a part of the Proud Boys, their names, Dominic Pozzola and Ethan Nordine. Ethan Nordine given 18 years in prison, and Dominic Pozzola, the man who set off the initial breach of the building by smashing a window with a riot shield, he got 10 years imposed by the federal district court judge. Again, these are the third and the fourth sentences imposed by the district court judge in Washington, D.C. upon this far-right nationalist group membership who tried, again, to overthrow the conduct of the election, attacking our democracy, assaulting the government operation on that day, assaulting our Capitol. Pozzola's sentence was only half of the 20 years that the government prosecutors had requested, and Nordine's was the stiffest penalty imposed so far in any case related to the Capitol attack, the same term given to Stuart Rhodes. Stuart Rhodes, a part of another group, he's the leader of the Oath Keepers militia, who was also found guilty of sedition in connection with January 6th. So we've got this very significant imposition of sentence on Ethan Nordine, 18 years. Nordine himself once ran a Proud Boys chapter in Seattle. He was granted war powers in the days leading up to January 6th by its leader, Enrique Tarrio. Of course, that's just internal to the Proud Boys operation, though less of a household name probably than Mr. Tarrio and some of the top lieutenants. No doubt Nordine rocketed to fame, got a lot of our attention at that time when a video of him surfaced that showed him knocking out a left-wing protester in Portland, Oregon with a single punch the year before. And all of that going viral. We saw him long before January 6th. Pozzola himself, what is his background? What is his status? He was a flooring contractor from Rochester, New York, best known for having appeared again in this video clip from January 6th, scraggly beard, wild mane of hair, hammering on a window of the Capitol with a stolen police riot shield. The videos, again, all of these prominently featured in these landmark trials in the federal district court, but also at public hearings. You may recall them well during the course of the hearings of the House Committee on January 6th. Pozzola, once again, was only one of the five men was charged in this case who was not specifically found guilty of this sedition charge. But the jury convicted him of six other felonies, including assaulting a police officer, conspiracy to keep members of Congress from certifying the election, and, yes, indeed, the destruction of one of the Capitol building's windows. Nordine also convicted of two other related conspiracies, one that accused him of disrupting the election certification and the other for interfering with the congressional duties and responsibilities, discharging their duties on January 6th as those were proceeding. Now, what happened during the course of those hearings in particular, these happening again on Friday involving these other two defendants. From the judge once again and from the bench, from Judge Kelly, discussing the differences between the Oath Keepers case, again, which Stuart Rhodes and five members of that militia convicted of sedition, and the Proud Boys case. He noted that Rhodes and his followers had brought an arsenal of weapons to Washington, D.C. on January 6th, increasing dramatically, as the judge said, the threat of serious bodily injury. And that the evidence in the Proud Boys case suggested the behavior of Nordine and his co-conspirators, as compatriots, if you will, were involved in several key breaches of the Capitol, were far more impactful on the day. So the judge went on to consider the sentence first of Pozzola. Okay, he's the former Marine, an amateur boxer. Government had long maintained he was the most aggressive of the five Proud Boys on trial in this case. Judge Kelly said this about Pozzola. He said he was an enthusiastic foot soldier in this conspiracy. What transpired on January 6th was the type of political violence that Pozzola signed up for and the Proud Boys partook of in on that day. This image, once again, of Pozzola breaking the window, sort of crystallized, if you will, kind of brought to the attention of the entire country, this entire attack upon the Capitol. One of the prosecutors said he was the literal poster boy of the conspiracy. And so that was the description given of Pozzola during the course of the proceeding. Pozzola himself, like many of these other defendants, apparently being somewhat deterred, at least initially, before the judge, apologized to his two daughters and to his longtime partner. Her name is Lisa McGee, saying this. He said, "I have broken this family and crushed your heart." Recognizing once again that he engaged in this conduct based upon his belief that what Donald Trump was telling him was true. In fact, it was wrong. He told Judge Kelly that he was a changed and humbled man, taking responsibility for his actions. At times, he said, "It feels like I'm living in an emotional black hole." Lisa McGee, the partner, detailed the ways in which Pozzola's case had harmed her and her family. Daughters losing friends, she said. They've suffered harassment and depression, unable to find work, and was financially destroyed. Judge Kelly, again, imposing the sentence upon Pozzola, noted that he was a relative newcomer to the Proud Boys. He had been acquitted of the seditious conspiracy charge. But nonetheless, he said, "You really were in some ways the tip of the spear that allowed people to get into the Capitol," describing once again his key involvement on January 6th. And then, despite having sworn in court during the course of the regular proceedings that he was, in fact, remorseful, had given up on politics, was sorry for what he had done, misled by the former president, after that, Pozzola, after the judge leaves the bench, Pozzola suddenly reversed himself as he's being taken away by the federal marshals to begin his service of his lengthy prison term. He raises his fist in the air and shouts with a smile, "Trump won. Trump won." Indeed, Mark, calling in, texting in this morning, identified specifically that as one of the most significant things happening during the course of this proceeding. Mark appropriately notes that there is no educating some people. Appreciate that comment, Mark. Appreciate that text coming in this morning as well. About an hour or so after that happens, again, Nordine's sentencing began. Again, this is Ethan Nordine. He's given 18 years imprisonment by the federal district court judge. He led the 200 Proud Boys or so under the Capitol grounds and toward a small area that day called the Peace Circle, where they eventually confronted the police. And after the attack, it was clear that Nordine left the Capitol feeling emboldened, as he said. The prosecutor said along the way that he recruited people, told them the government was the enemy, suggested training every 3 months. For what? Who can say but more than January 6th? So this indication that Nordine had his focus on January 6th, but much beyond that as well. Nordine, like Pozzola, also addressed Judge Kelly during the course of this proceeding post-trial of just this past week. And he said the attack was a complete and utter tragedy, something we've talked about a lot. Criminal prosecution, criminal investigation, all of these things. Tragic for our nation, tragic for the victims. 5 people died that day. Tragic for democracy, tragic for our republic as well, and indeed tragic for the defendants themselves and their families. Nordine himself, the defendant, said lots of people were seriously hurt. Some people lost their lives. Again, showing this sense of contrition on that day. He apologized and said he was sorely irresponsible for that day. He said, "I had to face the sobering truth. I didn't come to January 6th as an individual. I came as a leader. I came to keep people out of trouble and safe, but I failed." And that, of course, those are the statements of Nordine during the course of that proceeding. Judge Kelly said that the enhancement, this terrorism enhancement, technically applied to both men's cases as it did to that of Biggs and Rell the previous day, though he acknowledged once again that none of the Proud Boys engaged in the typical acts of terrorism like blowing up buildings or attacking military installations, which is sometimes what we associate with that particular enhancement. So all of this a part of the sentences imposed by the judge, by the Federal District Court Judge Kelly this past week, imposing in one case the highest penalty, along with that of Stuart Rhodes of many, many weeks and months ago, 18 years in prison. These other sentences, findings with respect to all of them, that they're involved in terrorism and that their conduct on that day not only needed to be deterred as to them in particular, but also sending these important messages to what was told to them by Donald Trump. Once again, not true, not accurate. The January 6th events, the product of misleading statements given, relayed, transmitted by our former president to people like this and 200 other members of the Proud Boys who were there on January 6th who engaged in this violent behavior. The reason why all of this is so significant, once again, the story about all of these people, almost all of the 1,100 who were out there, indicating that they were there by virtue of the invitation given to them by the former president, at that time the president of the United States of America, to their detriment, to their failure on that day to follow the law. And the consequences are now suffering by serving these extended periods of time in federal prison. That apart, that's a great civics lesson for them, regrettably, but also for the rest of us. Anybody else out there who might think of engaging in this kind of conduct, take a look at what happened just this past week in Washington, D.C. Again, these among 1,100 other cases proceeding in the federal district court. We will talk more about others down the road also convicted and going to be sentenced as a part of this overall mission, the largest undertaking ever by the United States Department of Justice in investigating and prosecuting people involved in January 6th. I indicated at the outset that we're going to talk not only about these sentencings that happened principally at the end, not quite the end. They can certainly appeal their sentences if they wanted to do so. But the end of at least this portion of the trials and the matters involving them in the federal district court. Beyond that, we have some news this past week about the imposition of a civil judgment in a case involving two election workers in Georgia, and the announcement about threats to election workers, and again, this sense of deterrence for those people who might threaten election workers in the future. Let's talk about that story first. Merrick Garland, the Attorney General of the United States of America, again, talking about the results, the things that happened after January 6th, announced an election worker task force, that again, an effort to try to identify anybody who is attacking election workers, not only from the past, but also in the future. This task force is going to be focused upon those people who would make threats to election workers to try to stop them from doing their jobs. And in particular, we'll talk about the impact upon two of them in Georgia in just a moment. The Department of Justice announcing on Thursday, that these rising threats against election workers throughout the nation, prompting the Department of Justice to announce to create this task force as convictions go forward. Two of them just this past week, those including two men in separate cases in Arizona and Georgia who pleaded guilty to threatening election officials in those states, brought by the U.S. Department of Justice as a part of this election threat task force. And that's brought now 14 cases nationwide as a part of this overall effort. When we come back, I'll tell you more about those particular prosecutions, and we'll talk about the civil case, the defamation case coming out of a court in Georgia, likewise involving threats to election workers in America.
Working hard is a long-standing tradition in Wisconsin. Some of the first labor unions formed here because of it. This Labor Day, join Earl Ingram as he hosts a special The Earl Ingram Show live from 8 to 11 a.m. at Labor Fest in Milwaukee.
Many people don't work on Labor Day, and so all they know is it's a day off. As a person who spent 34 years in labor and was a union man, I know the value of that.
Earl and his guests will discuss how Wisconsin's labor-related legislation became a model for other states, along with what unions look like now.
I've seen us go from that 30% union membership to now in Wisconsin, somewhere around 12%.
A union-led parade meets up with festgoers on the Summerfest grounds at 11. Labor Fest is free and open to all. Join Earl Ingram live this Labor Day, Monday, September 4th, starting at 8 a.m. from Labor Fest in Milwaukee, only here on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app.
The Todd Alba Show.
I see the silhouette of Todd Alba, who still hasn't figured out that maybe a TV person could help, you know, set this whole thing up.
For whatever reason, StreamYard's video is just deciding that the room is too bright.
When has Todd Alba been accused of being too bright? I mean, really there? I'm like, where's Aaron with the rim shot?
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
When you want something so badly, what you're able to justify and rationalize and get over. So I would say there's not a non-zero chance.
But what record would she run on? Foxconn?
I mean, what did she run on for governor? Probably the same thing.
I just remember her warning about people will be marrying coffee tables once gay marriage is allowed. So I'd like her to run just so I can ask her how many of those weddings she's been to.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
We are back. We're talking in this segment and a previous segment about the announcement just this past week by our Attorney General Merrick Garland of a new specialized task force that's going to focus on threats to election workers. And along the way, Merrick Garland identifying a couple of things that this task force has already accomplished, again, in deterring specific conduct and hopefully deterring others who might be out there thinking about engaging in threatening behavior as to our all-important election workers in America. Those included a 2.5-year sentence handed down just on Monday of this past weekend to an Iowa man who left voicemails threatening to hang officials, including former Attorney General Mark Brnovich of the state of Arizona. That kind of threat to public officials. On Thursday, an Ohio man pleaded guilty to sending a similar death threat to an election official with the Arizona Secretary of State's office. And also a Texas man pleaded guilty to posting a message online threatening several Georgia public officials following the 2020 election. All these people being identified, investigated, and prosecuted by this task force, obviously in place for a number of weeks and months already, announced this past week for two reasons. One, once again, to deter people from doing this, to investigate, but also, plainly, another important focus of law enforcement to prevent this kind of conduct. Word gets out that there is a particular task force inside the Department of Justice working to address these things to prevent the conduct in the first place, to deter it from happening, and to make certain that people know that if, once again, you engage in this kind of conduct, you will face the consequences. The task force, according to the Attorney General, reviewed over 1,000 contacts reported as being hostile or harassing by the election community nationwide. About 11% of those have already met the criminal prosecution thresholds, that is, decision-making thresholds by which the Department of Justice prosecutors will make a decision to go ahead and charge these people. Some very significant focus, again, upon the state of Wisconsin and other so-called swing states. 58% of these potentially criminal prosecution threats were in the key seven states in the 2020 election, the battleground states that we all well know. Involving, again, focus on lawsuits and recounts and audits, many of them, again, focusing upon threats to election workers. The names of those states, you know them well: Arizona, Georgia, Colorado, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Wisconsin. 58% of these complaints, 58% of the matters pending right now before this task force for possible prosecution coming out of those states as well. Garland, in particular, saying a functioning democracy requires that the public servants who administer our elections are able to do their jobs without fearing for their lives. The Justice Department will continue to investigate and prosecute those who target election officials and election workers as part of our broader efforts to safeguard the right to vote and defend our democracy. Well, there's another way. There's another way in which that can be pursued. And indeed, again, all of that criminal, the civil avenue is also out there. And we know well from our previous discussion that another one of those cases in a civil realm is also having that same impact. We may recall, well, this lawsuit, this civil defamation lawsuit brought by election workers Ruby Freeman and her daughter Shay Moss a civil lawsuit brought against Rudy Giuliani for defamation in federal district court based upon his statements, his public statements, his legislative statements, many of which have now gotten him into trouble in Georgia, as set forth in that omnibus Georgia indictment, saying that they were involved in some kind of election fraud when, in fact, just the opposite was the case. They were pursuing their duties and responsibilities effectively. That particular charge by Rudy Giuliani, investigated promptly, turned out to be completely false, debunked by the authorities there in Georgia. But Rudy Giuliani continuing to say that. Well, this past week, justice was done with respect to these election workers. We've heard their testimony a lot in the public domain about the impact upon their lives and their livelihood based upon the things that Rudy Giuliani said. This past week, some justice, imperfect justice, incomplete justice, imposed by the federal district court judge in Georgia. The federal judge entering a default judgment against Rudy Giuliani based upon these allegations of defamation. And the federal judge, Beryl Howell, the U.S. District Judge, ordering Rudy Giuliani to pay $130,000 in addition to the default judgment in lawyers' fees and costs for shirking his duty to turn over information that was also requested by the election workers during the course of their lawsuit. The lawsuit itself, from December 21 of 2021, accused Rudy Giuliani, again, one of Trump's lawyers, the confidants, one of the unindicted co-conspirators in the federal case, one of the named co-conspirators in the Georgia case, charging him with defaming these two by falsely stating that they had engaged in fraud, when in fact nothing was the case. They were in fact counting ballots appropriately at the State Farm Arena in Atlanta. Rudy Giuliani identifying a videotape saying they were engaged in fraudulent activity. They turned around and sued him, deterring him, hopefully, in the future from ever doing this again, and more importantly, arguably, deterring others who might make these similar false allegations against election workers in America. We've got two big stories coming out of just this past week involving the importance of election workers, the role they play, and the work of the criminal justice system, the work of the civil justice system in addressing this kind of conduct that would seek to try to stop or inhibit the good and legitimate work of our election workers nationwide. Coming out of Washington, D.C., a civil judgment against Rudy Giuliani, finding that he had, in fact, defamed those two, and also this announcement of the election worker task force and the criminal prosecutions against a number of people making threats against public officials in recent times. All of that, all a part of our stories coming out of law, justice, and the role of government and private individuals in America this past week. We've got a number of callers on the line right now. Let's begin with Joe from Madison. Joe, thanks for being with us this morning. Appreciate your comment or your call.
One question and then just one more comment. The question would be, as a federal prosecutor, can you respond to the question I have as to whether there is such a concept as good behavior, lowering a person's sentence in the federal jail or prisons? I was under the understanding that there was not such a thing, but then I read something about an 85% time served may get a person out. I'd be interested in your comments about that, how that may differ from a state prison court system. And then the other question I would have, or just comment I would have, was you made the earlier in the half hour, you were talking about how maybe not our typical picture of a terrorist act. And I think that's what's so interesting, Jim, and you've been talking about this. What we had was terrorism. It was terrorism battling cops. It was terrorism seeking to, you know, to hang the vice president. And I would also remind people of all of the legislators that were terrorized by these actions. They were cowering, afraid they were going to be killed. I mean, there's nothing more terrifying than to be on your hands and knees when you're in your workplace trying to survive it. So I'd be curious about your reaction to that comment, and I'd love to know your response to the earlier question about time served and whether that's something that plays into how long a person spends in federal prison. And thanks a lot, Jim. Appreciate it.
Joe, appreciate the call this morning, the comment, and I'm going to respond to both of those in the first moments of our second hour here. Important comments about both the sentencing and good behavior. We'll talk about that and also terrorism generally. To appreciate that comment, all of you, stay with us when we talk more about the administration of justice in America in our second hour here this morning on Morning Cannolis.
we're in the Civic Media Truth Booth at the Brown County Fair. We asked, and here's what you are telling us about living in the Green Bay area, attending the fair, and more.
Novalee Phelps. I work at the fair at Sheridan Amusements. I work with the Kitty Rides. I set up, tear down, wash them, and run them, make little kids happy. I run the raceway. I set it up, tear it down. I help with other kitty rides. I love to put a smile on kids' faces.
Thanks for sharing your story. Listen for more on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 97.9 FM, 1590 AM, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM, 98.3 FM, and the Civic Media app. And our website, civicmedia.us, and search for Truth Booth. And watch for the Civic Media Truth Booth coming to your town soon.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News
app.
I'm